Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Yesterday was one of those days in Washington that could either be a turning point in the eyes of history or just another day in current American politics. First, in the morning, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi emerged from a closed-door meeting with congressional Democrats to manage growing calls from her caucus to impeach President Trump.
Would you believe that it's important for to follow the facts? We believe that no one is above the law, including the President of the United States. And we believe that the President of the United States is engaged in a cover-up.
Pelosi then headed to the White House for a planned meeting with President Trump on infrastructure. But the president was not pleased. And after 3 minutes, he walked out of the cabinet room and into the Rose Garden.
Instead of walking in happily into a meeting, I walk in to look at people that had just said that I was doing a cover-up. I don't do cover-ups.
Well, also this week, the former White House counsel defied a congressional subpoena, and judges twice refused to block other subpoenas for the president's financial record. So today on Point, where we are now in the escalating tension between the president and congressional Democrats. And you can join us. What do you make of what happened yesterday, of what Speaker Pelosi said or how the president reacted? What do you think is the best way forward? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And a little later this hour, we will take a look at the implications of the release today of John Walker Lind, the so-called American Taliban. But first, let's go straight to Washington, where Siobhan Hughes joins us. She is the Wall Street Journal's reporter who covers Congress. Siobhan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, tell us, after all that happened yesterday, what are congressional Democrats thinking? Because it seems to me that there's a rising course, at least amongst freshman Democrats, for House Speaker Pelosi to pursue impeachment.
There is a growing call for Speaker Pelosi to pursue impeachment. The locus of that is the House Judiciary Committee, where Democrats feel that the White House has poked them in the eye time after time. Mr. Barr refused to testify, the Attorney General. He won't turn over an unredacted copy of the Mueller report or the underlying evidence. Don McGahn was a no-show in spite of a subpoena. And this has triggered a level of fury that has caused a concentration of Democrats on that committee to say, we need to pursue impeachment. That's matched, though, against another group that says, no, 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 we have to let the process play out. And chief among those people is Nancy Pelosi herself. So that's the tension.
Okay. So we're going to talk about that tension in much more detail for the remainder of this segment. But I did want to parse the politics of yesterday with you, Siobhan, because we can't really separate the political moment from the investigations or the legal underpinning of where we are now. So, because in your report, we see that in that meeting that was supposed to happen at the White House, the drapes in the cabinet room were closed, and clearly there was already a podium out in the Rose Garden. So the president had every intention of giving a press conference of some kind. So let's listen to what Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said about that.
It's clear that this was not a spontaneous move on the president's part. It was planned. When we got in the room, the curtains were closed. The president, there was a place for him at the front so he could stand and attempt to tell us why he wouldn't do infrastructure. And, of course, then he went to the Rose Garden with prepared signs that had been printed up long before our meeting.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer there. But Siobhan Hughes, did House Speaker Nancy Pelosi provide the president with even more ammunition when earlier in the day she used that phrase, cover-up?
She absolutely did. The irony here is that Nancy Pelosi has been the person who is holding off the swelling tide of calls for impeachment. So in that sense, she's almost in alignment with the president. However, by using those words, cover up, that was like waving a red drape in front of a bull. It set the president off, and it clearly, if no matter what his plans were, definitely would have motivated him to go out to the Rose Garden and blast the Democrats.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what the president did say in the Rose Garden. Here he is.
They want to make this a big deal. Whether or not they carry the big I word out, I can't imagine that, but they probably would because they do whatever they have to do. I'll tell you, there's a danger here. If someday a Democrat becomes president and you have a Republican House, they can impeach him for any reason or her. Any reason. We can't allow that to happen.
Siobhan Hughes, I still want to focus on the fact that this the podium was ready and the sign was there with all the some of the facts from the Mueller investigation. I mean, it seems as if no matter what came out of the infrastructure meeting, if it had ever even happened, the president is very much wanting to talk about the I word, as he says right now, more than anything. Why is that?
Two things are true. Number one, about half of the public does not think the House should begin impeachment proceedings. And so that works against the Democrats. Number two, Trump knows that. He also knows that bringing up impeachment motivates his base. And so politically, there is a sense in which talking about impeachment is beneficial to Mr. Trump himself.
So this puts House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, as you said, in a very interesting position right now. I mean, she always is, but this is a new kind of interesting position because yesterday, also on the same day, later on, she spoke at the Center for American Progress's annual ideas conference. And here's what she said about what she believes sees as the president's stonewalling of congressional investigations.
In plain sight, in the public domain, this president is obstructing justice. And he's engaged in a cover-up. And that could be an impeachable offense. Ignoring the subpoenas of Congress was Article 3 of the Nixon impeachment.
So, Siobhan, is the House Speaker here in using this language, is she signaling to those restive Democrats? Why is she saying something as specific as that now?
Number one, she's channeling the sentiments of her caucus, which is inching towards impeachment. The majority is not there yet, but that's where they're headed. Number two, she's got to open up a release valve a little bit because there is a group of Democrats that desperately wants to pursue impeachment. And she does need to acknowledge that group in order to keep her caucus together.
Well, Siobhan, hold on for a second here, because I want to introduce into the conversation now Jill Wine-Banks. She's joining us from Evanston, Illinois. She was a Watergate special prosecutor, and she served as general counsel of the United States Army from 1977 to 1980 and has written extensively about the political moment we find ourselves in now. Jill Wine-Banks, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So there is this question about whether or not impeachment proceedings, should they go forward, would they more resemble the Nixon administration or what happened to President Bill Clinton? And you've recently written that you think it's more Nixon-esque. And why is that?
It's definitely more Nixon-esque, although I did say also that because everything that Donald Trump does is so unprecedented, because it's so without any parallel in history, because he's really, truly the first really lawless president, it's probably not predictable from history. But the reason I say it's more comparable to Nixon is that the crimes involved are the kind that Nixon was involved in. We're talking about obstruction of justice. Donald Trump's are worse because they involve a foreign government in addition, but the obstruction part, which is laid out very clearly in the Mueller report and in plain sight for everybody to see, are much more like that. Also, the argument against impeachment that's being made is that, oh, it would help him and hurt the Democrats. There's no evidence of that. If you analyze the statistics, the argument that it helped Clinton is just false. He started out before impeachment with a 66% approval rating, and at the end, he was at 66%. Whereas Nixon, as the facts came out, his approval rating, a man who had won 49 out of 50 states and a landslide in the popular vote, went down to, at one point, 17%, but basically around 24%. He just plummeted because people saw the truth. They saw the facts. They heard the evidence. Mm. And whereas in the case of Clinton, people heard evidence and went, that's just nonsense. That's not important. I don't believe it, and it doesn't matter. In the case of Nixon, they heard it, and they changed. And that's like the juror in the Manafort case, Paula Duncan, who said, I'm a loyal Trump supporter, and I think this whole thing is a hoax and a witch hunt. But the evidence in the Manafort case led me to vote to convict Manafort on all 18 mm-hmm. counts.
Well, Jill Winebank, though, let me ask you, in the case of President Clinton, he was impeached towards the end of his second term in office. He wasn't going to run again. In the case of President Nixon, the impeachment proceedings were in advance of a midterm election. But here we are now in the case of President Trump, that if indeed impeachment proceedings go forward, it would be in advance of a potential, his potential re-election. And I think, is that not why Democrats actually see this as distinctly different from, say, the Clinton proceedings? They do see, House Speaker Pelosi does see this as a potential weakness going into the 2020 presidential elections.
No, I don't see how it's different if it's a midterm or if it's a presidential election. The Democrats gained seats after the Clinton impeachment. It's true. And that's because, as I said, he never lost popularity because there was a totally bungled impeachment. So if the evidence is presented in a good way, if we are allowed, and remember, right now, we're not talking about just stonewalling on the Mueller investigation. We're talking about stonewalling on a scale that has never been seen in American history, ever. He is stonewalling on financial records, on his taxes. He's stonewalling on immigration policy. He's stonewalling on whether or not there was corruption in the granting of security clearances. We cannot have any kind of government if Congress cannot find out facts about how we are being governed.
Right. Well, and Jill Winebanks, I'm just going to take a quick break here. Forgive me for interrupting you. And Siobhan Hughes, stand by for just a second. We are talking about where we are now in those escalating tensions between President Trump and congressional Democrats. And we want to hear from you. What was your reaction when you heard yesterday the Speaker of the House say the president has engaged, in her words, quote, a cover-up? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking today about the escalating tensions between congressional Democrats and President Donald Trump. And I'm joined today by Siobhan Hughes. She is the Wall Street Journal's congressional reporter with us from Washington. Jill Winebanks also joins us. She's with us from Evanston, Illinois. She was a Watergate special prosecutor and served as general counsel of the United States Army from 1977 to 1980. And let's listen to what some congressional Democrats themselves said yesterday on CNN, New York Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez acknowledged the difficulty of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's position, she says, but she also said she's in favor of opening an impeachment inquiry.
I trust the Speaker is taking a measured approach to ensure that we're moving everyone forward. I know that, you know, being a Speaker is hard. Holding this party together is a difficult task, but I think that we know what we need to do. I personally believe that I think we have to move forward.
On the other hand, South Carolina Democratic Congressman James Clyburn, who serves in the leadership as the majority whip, told NPR's All Things Considered yesterday he wants to continue investigating the president, but do it within the court system.
We are doing what we think is necessary to lay the foundation for being successful in court. And just because our emotions tell us, and even the facts that we see tell us, that the end result is what we think it will be, we still have to go through the process. We still have to lay a foundation. We can't overlook that and just rush to the impeachment.
It's Representative James Clyburn. Siobhan Hughes, let me just ask you a quick question here. Is there a generational divide that we're seeing playing out amongst Democrats? Because it seems as if the Democrats who remember what it was like in the late 90s with President Clinton, that many of them, even in some of the perhaps more purple districts, are saying, hang on, let's slow down.
That's exactly right. People who remember the Clinton years remember that impeachment backfired on Republicans, and Democrats don't want to be in that spot themselves right now. They're also running into something, to pick up on something that Jill said. They do believe that the public could be educated to the point that generally people would support impeachment. The problem is the two main narrators of this, former White House counsel Don McGahn and the special counsel Robert Mueller, have yet to appear to testify before the committee. They are really the main narrators. And without those voices, Mr. McGahn has blocked a subpoena. Mr. Mueller is still not ready to come in and testify, at least not in public. Without those narrators, it's very hard to bring the public along, is the way the Democrats see it.
Right. And so, Jill, let me turn back to you on that. Would it be more advisable for Democrats then to begin impeachment proceedings to help enforce those subpoenas? Or can they not make more progress within what they can perform as congressional in their own congressional investigations?
I think that it is clear that if they declare impeachment, it ups the game in the sense of the courts are 100% sure to support their ability to get evidence. I believe that they can get the same evidence even without declaring it impeachment. I have been urging fact-finding hearings, so following up, I clearly agree with what Siobhan is saying, and that there should be an education process. That's the most important, because that's what brought Nixon down, was that people saw the witnesses, they judged the credibility, and they went, the witnesses are telling the truth, the president is lying. And that's what we need here, is to have people be able to evaluate the evidence itself. And there's plenty of evidence. I think the Mueller report is actually as much a smoking gun as the tape recording in which President Nixon is heard saying, well, we can always use the CIA to stop the FBI, and then, you know, things like, and we can raise $1 million to pay off hush money to keep the burglars quiet so that nobody knows that we paid them. But we have that kind of information. And Siobhan is right. We need to hear McGahn. We need to hear everybody. It's not just McGahn, and it's not just Mueller. And Mueller's only important because of anything that Barr did to misrepresent the Mueller report, not because I want him to summarize the evidence. I don't. I want to hear the substantive witnesses. That's what people need. In Watergate, we had the Senate hearings preceding the indictment, then we had the indictment, and then there were very brief impeachment hearings. The impeachment was based mostly on the evidence that we had gathered and presented to the Judiciary Committee by court order. And there is no question that all the grand jury evidence that has been gathered by Mueller can be given to the Judiciary Committee right now. If anybody went to court, the judge would approve it. And there's a second exception that allows release of grand jury testimony that we didn't have because it passed after 9/11. And that is one that when there's a foreign hostile act and Congress has the ability to prevent another foreign hostile act if they can be informed of it, then they get the grand jury testimony. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't require Barr. It doesn't require any government intervention. That is something that can be done. I mean, sorry, it doesn't mean any court intervention.
Right.
Barr could do that on his own today. And if anybody in really cared about transparency, that's what Barr would do.
Well, you know, I want to get to callers because we got a lot of people who want to have a say. So let's go straight to them. Let's roll through a bunch of them, in fact. Let's go to Jerry first, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Jerry, you're on the air. What's your thought?
Hi, this is Jerry. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a 72-year-old man, and I've been listening to this debate for some time. Both sides have a point. The strategy behind the Democratic Party should be really considered. We're dealing with a strong man, whether we like his activities or not. And every kind of division, every kind of hesitation on going towards what we know is justifiable in the impeachment is a sign of weakness to the general public. Now, Mr. Trump is not going to lose votes by the impeachment process to the people who cling to him now. That'll be remain the same. Mm-hmm. They'll just be louder. But for the people on the other side, they're looking quietly, like myself, to some action, not out of blind foolishness that we think we're actually going to win, but to do what is required by the Constitution to stop from this executive overreach.
Right.
Like I said, I'm a 72-year-old man, and I looked at this, and I was an activist back in the old days, and I saw the same thing evolve until somebody took it to court and brought and exposed the very things that was your last person just mentioned.
Right. So Jerry, thank you so much for your call. And let's get a response to Jerry's perspective from Lisa, who's calling from Rochester, New York. Lisa, you just heard caller Jerry there. Do you think that impeachment is constitutionally mandated at this point and would be a meaningful action?
Hi. No, I do not. And I'm a 61-year-old woman. So, I think more respect is needed for experienced politicians like Nancy Pelosi. Cortez gets a soundbite why she got elected, and then she was an egotistical bull in the china shop. She killed the Amazon deal that an experienced politician, Governor Andrew Cuomo, had won for the working-class New Yorkers. So, no, I think that you let Trump impeach or indict himself by his own batard. Pelosi is sage in that. I think the Dems need to start pushing their own legislation through. Let it fail in the racist Senate. Then that's the news, not the Trump tweet. Let it fail by the racist tweeter in the White House. Then that's the news.
Hmm.
You know, you know what I mean? I think that the tail is wagging the dog here.
Well,
and I think that a lot of the criticism of Pelosi is just misogynist.
Interesting. Well, Lisa, thank you for your call. Lisa in Rochester there. Let's go to Leo, who's calling from New Orleans. Leo, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is this. It seems to me that the last election was lost because people weren't really motivated to vote. I think this time there's a lot more who will be motivated to vote against Trump. So wouldn't it make kind of more sense to work on, for Democrats to focus on issues that matter to the voters, win the election, and then just prosecute Trump as a private citizen when he has some more power of the executive branch? I'm not really sure how that all works. That's what I'm kind of asking. Why is impeachment preferable or even a good way to go when he could pardon himself or anything like that?
Leo, thank you for your call. Jill Winebanks, would you like to respond to that interesting question that Leo left us with? Why do you think impeachment is preferable?
Okay, I thank you, Leo, for that question. I think it's a really good one. I want to point out that the Congress can do two things at once. During the impeachment of Clinton, there were 150 bills signed, major legislation was included in that. And the same thing was true during the Watergate era. A lot of major legislation happened. People cared, and I agree that the Democrats must address the key issues of concern to all of us out here in America. I want them to do that. But they also have a constitutional obligation and a moral imperative to take action when a president acts in a lawless manner. And the number of things that this president has done to stymie what we would consider normal democracy is something that cannot be ignored without peril to democracy itself. So that's why I think we need to go ahead. We need to do both. Definitely have to do both, and we can do both. And I think that if people hear the facts, they will be more motivated. One of the callers who basically said that the people who support Trump will never change, I believe that's true. They aren't listening to the facts, and they don't, you know, they have their opinion, and they're entitled to their opinion, but they aren't entitled to their facts. I hope that, like the Manafort juror, they will listen to the facts and be persuaded. Mm-hmm. But I think there are a number of people who, as has been pointed out, weren't motivated to vote because they didn't love Hillary. They really didn't like Trump. And it's a mistake to say, I'm not going to vote because I don't love either of them, because one of the two is going to be president. Mm-hmm. And you may as well pick, whether you like either, you may as well pick the best of the two. And so I think we should really go ahead with the facts getting out. And if that's through impeachment or through just an ordinary hearing, that's what we need to do.
Well, Siobhan Hughes, let me turn back to you on something, because I hear what Jill Wine Banks is saying, but like in the same line of thinking, perhaps precisely because President Trump is so unorthodox in his presidency and in his candidacy, that it's completely understandable why, experienced politicians like House Speaker Pelosi might genuinely be concerned about how impeachment proceedings would affect the Democratic Party just next year. I mean, we're already in the election cycle. So the idea that talk of impeachment is playing right into his hands is a powerful motivator for some Democratic leaders.
It is a powerful motivator, and there are some data to back up their point. There were data released this week from a firm called Catalyst that found that Democrats' gains last November compared to what happened in the 2016 election year could be chalked up to Trump voters deciding to vote for Democratic candidates instead of just getting more Democrats out to vote.
And to respond to what Jill Wine Banks has said a couple of times, that, you know, political leaders, Congress can walk and chew gum at the same time, essentially. I mean, are Democrats also making that argument?
There are some Democrats who are making that argument, particularly those on the investigative committees like the Judiciary Committee. The problem is that Democratic bills are likely to die in the Senate, where Mitch McConnell has not the same agenda that the Democrats have. And so the message of the Democratic bread and butter agenda does tend to get lost amidst these investigations.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Neil, who's calling from Portland, Maine. Neil, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. As a counterargument that this would help Trump if we impeach, I believe that right now the Democrats are looking quite cowardly for not impeaching. And come 2020, if we don't impeach, it will make Trump look innocent, and I think he'll use that against us while campaigning. Anyway, thank you for taking my call.
Neil, thanks for calling. Let's go to Joseph, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Joseph, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I disagree with the last caller. I was raised a Democrat, and I believe the Democrats are shooting themselves in the foot with this grandstanding posturing politically, calling an impeachment every other day with no foundation for it. It seems like they're scrambling, and they don't have a viable candidate at this time, and it's got me perplexed as to the route they're taking. It looks like they're shaking in their shoes. Every time something goes on, they scream impeachment, and I think it's helping him.
Well, Joseph, let me ask you a question. Some Democrats are screaming impeachment. Obviously, the leader of the party right now, House Speaker Pelosi, is not. But let me ask you, you said grandstanding. Is it also grandstanding when the president of the United States tells his former White House counsel, defy a congressional subpoena and do not show up to testify?
I think he's well within his rights to do this, because I believe the Mueller report closed it, the door on any further investigation. And to continue with this on and on and on and not have another candidate ready to go against him, it just looks bad. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, I think it's a losing battle for them to continue on with this.
Okay. So, Joseph, do you not want to hear what Don McGahn has to say publicly?
No, not really. I think it's over. You know, you want to continue with testifying Mueller and, you know, getting him up there, Don McGahn. I think it's over.
Right. Well, Joseph, I'm going to take it back from you there, because we just got 2 minutes left, and I want to get Jill Wine Banks' response to what Joseph just said, because, Jill, you've said repeatedly that the educating the public is where you see the most important effort should be placed right now. But we just have Joseph saying there that even though he's a Democrat, he doesn't necessarily even want to hear it.
Well, I'm sorry, Joseph, that you don't want to hear it, because I think if you did, it might change your mind. And I just want to point out that there's a big difference between the job that Mueller was assigned to do and what Congress is assigned to do. Mueller had to look at whether there were any existing criminal laws that had been violated. Congress has to look at whether there is a danger to democracy from the actions of the president. The second thing is that if you read the Mueller report, you will see that Mueller did not say there was no criminal action. Mueller said there are a number of actions that violate obstruction of justice, but the Office of Legal Counsel, the Department of Justice, will not let me bring an indictment. So this has to be turned over to Congress for Congress to take political action, which is impeachment. So I think the people are misperceiving what the Mueller report is and don't realize how damaging the Mueller report is to the president.
Well, Jill Winebanks, joining us from Evanston, Illinois, former Watergate special prosecutor. Jill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And Siobhan Hughes, Wall Street Journal congressional reporter with us from Washington. Siobhan, it was great to have you as well. Thank you so very much.
Good to be here.
Well, we have to take a quick break, folks. But when we come back, we're going to take a look at some of the big questions surrounding the release today of John Walker Lind. He's the American who spent 17 years in prison for aiding the Taliban after 9/11. And we want to hear from you. What do you make of John Walker Lind's release? And what should we do to make sure people convicted of terrorism-related offenses don't re-engage in extremism? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 18 years ago, John Walker Lind's bearded, groggy face was splashed across newspapers and televisions around the world. He was branded the so-called American Taliban. He'd converted to Islam as a teenager, left California to study Arabic in Yemen, and ended up in Afghanistan aiding the Taliban. There he met Osama bin Laden, and he fought against U.S.-backed forces. He was captured and sentenced to 2 decades in prison. He served 17 years. And this morning, John Walker Lind was released over the objections of several political leaders and the family of a CIA officer who was killed in an uprising at the Afghanistan detention center where Lind was being held back in 2001. So we're going to talk about John Walker Lind's release and the bigger question of what do we do, or do we know what to do with former extremists who serve their time? Joining us from Washington is Josh Meyer, investigative reporter and author who covers national security issues. He's written for the LA Times, NBC News, Politico, and Time Magazine, amongst many others. And he's been with us since the beginning of this program, frequently joining On Point in the days right after 9/11. Josh Meyer, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here again.
Also with us from Washington is Bennett Clifford. He's a research fellow at the George Washington University Program on Extremism. He studies violent extremist movements. And you can find a link to his report titled Radicalization in Custody. It's about terrorism prevention in the U.S. federal prison system. That link is at onpointradio.org. Bennett Clifford, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for having me on.
So, Josh, let me start with you. 17 years is quite a long time, and maybe there are a lot of people who actually aren't that familiar with John Walker Lind's story. So take us back. Just remind us how significant his story and his capture was back in 2001 and 2002.
Well, thanks, Meghna. I mean, it really does take me back to the first days of the war on terrorism, which was a very, very crazy time. His is a very compelling story. It's also a very complicated one. When he was first captured, he was in a detention center where there was a riot and there was a lot of violence, and that's where Johnny Mike Spann was killed. But it doesn't appear that there's any evidence specifically, at least from that time, that he was a terrorist. He was somebody who had developed an interest in Islam. He had gone to Yemen to study. He then went to Pakistan and ended up in Afghanistan and ended up in this detention center. And there are these now iconic photos, video images of him being filthy and flea bitten and sitting with a bunch of other people when the uprising took place. But, you know, over the years, he became sort of dropped from sight. He was the first person to be convicted of a crime in the war on terror. And there have not been all that many others specifically convicted of crimes committed overseas who are in U.S. detention. And I think people forgot about him over the years. And so now that he's coming, he was released this morning, it raises a whole raft of issues and questions about what to do with people like this. How do you rehabilitate people, if you can even do that, whether he should be welcomed back into society and so forth. And then, of course, there's now this question about whether he was writing letters in support of ISIS and other radicalized groups and what to do with that information.
Right. But Josh, if I remember correctly, Lind actually he pleaded guilty, right, to aiding the Taliban.
He did. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Bennett Clifford, tell us, what do we know about Lind's 17 years in prison? As Josh Meyer just said, there seem to be some reports that he may not have been de-radicalized at all while in custody, in federal custody.
Yeah, and it's sort of hard to put it in context because right after he was – or I should say after he pled guilty and was going through the sentencing process, he made a number of statements that would appear to indicate that he had rejected the idea of violence, rejected jihadism and al-Qaeda more broadly. But then as the years go on, he spends time in prison. And Joss alluded to this. There's a number of reports from both the Federal Bureau of Prisons and the National Counterterrorism Center that reported that Lind was – making statements in favor, again, of violent jihadism and the use of violence in military conquest, even expressing support for the Islamic State in 2015 and 2016 letters. Even beyond that, there are also reports from the Bureau of Prisons that he was networking and engaging with other extremists that were incarcerated in the same prison of him in Terre Haute, Indiana as well. So getting to some of these statements, it's interesting to see the contradiction. It's interesting to see how his views may have developed potentially as a result of his prison sentence over that 17 years.
Okay, interesting. So on that point, let's listen to what Allison Spann, who's the daughter of the CIA officer who was killed in 2001, as Josh Meyer reminded us, a CIA officer who was killed in the same Afghan detention center where Lind was held for a while. That officer was Mike Spann, and his daughter, again, Allison Spann, spoke to CNN last night about why she's very upset about Lind's release.
To learn that a known terrorist, who there are reports that he is still carrying out his terrorist activity while in prison, is being let out early for good behavior, it does feel like a slap in the face to my family. And it does feel very personal. And we would like for there to be an investigation into these reports to see if, in fact, he is still radicalized before we release him to the public.
That's Allison Spann speaking on CNN last night. So Josh Meyer, respond to what she's saying here, that as Bennett pointed out, there's still considerable concern that he might have actually been, I don't know, even more radicalized while in prison.
Well, yeah, that's a very good question. And that does happen a lot. I think as Bennett can speak to this issue probably more than I can, a lot of people go into the U.S. prison system and the jail system on the lower the local level with some level of radicalization, and they end up getting a lot more of it when they're in prison. I mean, it's a petri dish or an incubator of a lot of violent ideologies that run the gamut of it's not just Islamic ones, but you know, Black Power groups, Hispanic groups, gangs, and so forth. But I think what's important, though, is making the distinction between radical ideology and terrorism. So I don't think anybody has really made a specific case that he was a terrorist. He clearly was somebody who was in with the wrong crowd, espousing their views. If you recall, though, before 9/11, the Taliban, even though they'd been designated as a terrorist group by the United States, were not really perceived as a terrorist organization. What their sin was at the time, and it's a very serious one, is that they were harboring al-Qaeda and allowing them to use their training camps there. They were also trafficking in heroin and all sorts of other bad things. But, you know, so whether you can pin all that on Lind isn't clear. I wish the Bureau of Prisons had seen their way through to releasing more information about him, his time in prison, what the reports about his ideology and his behavior have and how they've developed over the years. I mean, it would be great to see more information about why they're so concerned about him. I mean, some of that stuff is confidential, but in this case, in the interest of transparency and the public interest in the case, that maybe they could provide more information about why they released him.
So Bennett Clifford, pick up on that thought. I mean, Josh does point out that do we fully understand yet the connection, if or how deep the connection is between radicalization and terrorism, as Josh points out?
I would build off one thing, which is the idea of prisons as incubators, or even some people suggest a petri dish for radicalization. I think that's more a function of the circumstances within prison and the individual in question. There are some folks who enter into prison with those base ideas and end up rejecting them, but that's not going to be every case. And it's important to look at the specific context in question, where Lynn spent his time in prison, who he was spending it around with. Did he have access to other individuals that could have potentially either goaded him on or provided him access to the types of materials that would build his philosophy stronger and allow him to be more radicalized. But I think there's another policy question that I'd like to get into a little bit, which is just this idea of early release. I think that's the center point of the debate. And currently, as it stands, the Bureau of Prisons doesn't have a good way, I would argue, of incorporating assessments of an individual prisoner's radicalization or their level of extremism into decisions about whether they're supposed to be released early. That's based off good conduct, which is a function of their behavior in prison and whether they're violating any institutional rules. You can, as I guess strange as it would sound, espouse jihadist ideology, pledge support for Islamic State. And in most federal prisons guidelines, that wouldn't constitute a rules violation that could potentially put you back or allow you to serve out the rest of the sentence.
Are you suggesting that that's something that the Federal Bureau of Prisons ought to reassess?
Potentially. I think the prerequisite for that is determining effective indicators for helping the Bureau of Prisons assess the level of radicalization and extremism within inmates, and more specifically, whether there's any change over time. Yeah. So doing risk assessments at the beginning and end of someone's sentence in prison to determine that change. I think that's effective, but the Bureau of Prisons may want to reconsider, pursuant to this case, whether decisions about radicalization should factor into whether someone serves out all their sentence or good conduct.
Well, let's get some calls in here. Let's go to Dale, who's calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Dale, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was I didn't actually meet the young man, but I was actually on the capture team in Afghanistan when he was captured. And I served in Iraq and Afghanistan for more than 7 years during the global war on terror. And this is my point. And I think the last speaker just made a very clear point. There's nothing against the law about what you think. And as somebody who's wounded twice in combat, I've got zero problem with this gentleman being released, and nobody else should either. I mean, he was indoctrinated as a very young man. And regardless of what he thinks now, there is a fine line between terrorism, which is actually a criminal act, and to my knowledge, he's engaged in no acts of terrorism. And my heart goes out to the family of the CIA officer that was killed, but she said it herself in her statement. I mean, yeah, he's probably radicalized, but that's not against the law.
And Dale, can I just ask you a quick question? Yeah, so don't hang up, Dale. You said you didn't meet Lind on the day he was captured, but you were on the capture team that did.
I was providing routine security for the capture team when the raid was held.
You remember that day?
Of course.
What was it like?
It was hot.
I'm not making light of this, Dale. I mean, that was a major moment in the very earliest days of the war on terror.
As a soldier with a career goal of all other soldiers, and that's to see the next sunrise. I mean, you have to understand, you go on hundreds of these types of missions where, you know, hey, you're going to attempt capture a high-value guy, and out you go, and then a lot of times nothing ever happens. I mean, you sit around for, you know, the better part of a day, sometimes 14, 15 hours, and then nothing happens. The only thing different about this particular day was that the guy actually, you know, they actually got the person. And, you know, and at the time, I mean, you have to realize, you know, a lot of us didn't even know who this cat was. I mean, but then later on you find out about it, you know, and then in my post-Army career, I've spent a lot of time talking about radicalization, Islamophobia, and, you know, what's going on in our country in the last segment when you talked about what's going on with the president, you know, about how thought is being criminalized in the United States of America. And this man, don't forget, he was a teenager. when he was went to Afghanistan. And I love my daughter to death, don't get me wrong, but she has some strong political opinions, but I'm hard-pressed to hold her accountable for something that she says now, 20 years later.
Well, Dale, thank you so much for your call. Josh Meyer, you want to respond to what Dale said?
Well, I think he makes a lot of very good points. I was just about to reiterate that even though I said that he's not a terrorist, I mean, let's be clear about this. I mean, John Walker Lind made a lot of statements that were very, very conclusive about advocating violence, advocating jihad, hoping that there's a caliphate established according to the prophecies, and he is in support of that. But again, that's not being a terrorist, and I was actually just trying to find on my phone right now while waiting examples of other people who have actually been convicted of terrorist attacks in the war on terrorism who got a lot lighter sentences than he did, and I can't find one right now. But, you know, 17 years is a very long time, and there are other people. I was looking at Bowie Bergdahl, the U.S. Soldier who went AWOL, and others who have done things that were much more serious. You know, there's talk now about Trump pardoning some of these special operations guys who were taking sniper shots at innocent civilians. So it's a very, very complicated situation. It's apples to oranges. But it is important to note, as Dale said, that he was a teenager. He was being shuffled from Yemen to Pakistan to Afghanistan, and you don't really know what kind of indoctrination there was. These camps are very good at that. I've written a lot about them, the training camps. He also was, you know, probably a prisoner of some sort in that he felt that he had to espouse those kind of views as well. So what I would love to see also is Johnny Mike Spann had interviewed him or interrogated him before he was killed. And I'd love to hear what he got from that interview, what Lynn said, et cetera.
Well, Bennett Clifford, we've got about a minute and a half left, and I just want to point out that the terms of Lynn's probation are pretty strict, right? He won't be allowed to go online or owning a web-capable device without permission from his probation officer, barred from traveling internationally or getting a passport. Other provisions require mental health counseling and prohibitions from communicating with any known extremists or watching or reading materials that reflect extremist views. Those are the terms of his release, but it doesn't also seem as if we have sort of a comprehensive plan on what to do or how to reintegrate people like Lind, do we?
No, I wouldn't say we do, especially at the probation level. And the things that are applied in Lind's case, which, as you noted, are very severe in terms of how these cases go, won't be applicable to the per estimates, about 100 people convicted of terrorism-related offenses who will be released before 2023. It's important to keep in mind that not everybody will be a John Walker Lind, and those types of very severe restrictions could potentially push them further into radicalization, especially if they're at a lower level of that stage.
Wow. Well, Bennett Clifford, research fellow at the Program on Extremism at the George Washington University. We have a link to his report titled Radicalization in Custody. That link is at onpointradio.org. Bennett, thank you so very much.
Thank you again for having me on.
And Josh Meyer, investigative reporter and author who covers national security issues, has written for the LA Times, NBC News, Politico, amongst other, with us today from Washington. Josh, it's great to have you back. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.